Welcome to Advertising Week Europe 2024 in audio, powered by The Barbershop. In this podcast, we'll bring you the latest insights and trends from industry leaders in advertising and marketing. Join us as we dive into discussions that shape the future of our industry.
Welcome, everybody. It's an absolute pleasure to be here and to be on stage with two veterans, shall we say, in the nicest possible way, of the marketing industry. Between them, they've worked for some of the world's biggest brands, Boots, P&G, Electrolux, never mind the day jobs that they do today. So please do keep questions coming in. I think the Slido signs are up. Submit as much as you like, and we'll come to those just a bit later. But I'm going to kick us off with our discussion for today. So welcome, Nicola, Edwin. Thank you so much for being with us on a Wednesday early afternoon after everybody's digesting their lunch. We've been talking about all sorts of things in the wings, but let's start with the job of transformation in marketing and just how tough it is to be a CMO today. Every week seems to bring another article about the demise of the CMO and just how tough it is to keep going in an industry where it's all change, please, every day of the week. So, Nicola, I know you don't subscribe to that for obvious reasons, but tell us why.
Yeah. Hi, everybody. It's lovely to be here. Thanks for coming back after lunch. Look, I might be biased, but I think the role of a CMO is just more important than ever. And it comes down for me for a simple equation that in a world that is changing so fast at such a pace where nobody knows the answers, the only way to drive clarity through a world like that can be to put the customer at the centre of what the question is. And the customer question sits nowhere better, in my opinion, than with the CMO. And if you can be the voice of the customer, then whatever the future holds, however uncertain it is, you can drive some unity in your organization and some clarity on what you're going to do moving forward. And as long as you are doing something in service of what your customer needs, you can have a confidence that you're going to be doing something right. So it is a challenging time for marketing. Where does everything sit? Which part of the organization does it sit in? Who does what? But for me, it's never been more exciting. It's a time where there is so much change for us to step into. It's also terrifying because what do you do first? But what better career to go after with those kind of challenges? And I think it's an awesome time for marketers.
So let's talk a little bit about the dynamics at the top table. And I think there are challenges in terms of who gets to run the agenda. Is it strategy? Is it innovation? Is it foresight? Is it marketing? You've spoken a bit to that. But Edwin, let me come to you. I know your day job is to challenge the bosses to think more into the future. Talk to me a little bit about why that matters so much and how you do it.
Yes. So I think it's part of the transformation of insight as a mindset as well. I think the historical view of an insights professional has been like the librarian, like a guardian of knowledge, and the person who comes and brings some data to the table, or who supports a claim, or who supports an idea that someone is already passionate about. And I think nowadays is more kind of how we combined what I call the three kind of consciousness levels. So hindsight, insight, and foresight. And I think it's really important to learn from the past. That's what I mean by hindsight. So what we have done, where we come from, what has worked and not worked. Because I think we always like to talk about successes, but what can we learn about non-successes in the past? Insights, okay, what are we discovering now? What are the current trends? What do we need to act as of today? And then foresight, what will be coming forward, you know, what is the future that we are building? And I know it's a little bit of a cliche, but it comes back to fundamentals. I see it as, you know, the what, so what, and now what. And I think if you can answer those questions on the table, you are off to a good start on creating some transformational change. I think the biggest challenge is that we are used most of the time to the hindsight. What happened? In some cases, then we go to insights. What happened and where we are. But in very few cases, we are really thinking what will be happening. And I think that's where we need to really focus and kind of have a clear point of view on how our brands will take that journey and the next steps towards the future.
So, I mean, challenging ourselves to think of the future is obviously pretty difficult thing to do when there's just so much pressure day to day. Nicola, let me come to you on that. You talked about future consumer and showing up to them in new and different ways. And of course, you're having to do that and try to do that at scale, but also deal with the problems of a consumer that's more fragmented. There are more tribes, more segments, more micro-targeting to think about than ever. How can you balance those two things out?
Yeah, and is this not a challenge for all of us? I mean, we have to live in both worlds. So we have to today be able to address all of the kind of micro-targeting opportunities that exist and how you operate across all those platforms out there, the TikToks, the X, the Metas, and everything new coming out and about, and the opportunities that come through data and CRM and targeting and everything that is on our plate. And you have to do that because ultimately that is how you drive the business today. And to the question about Chief Financial Officer, they're going to be knocking on your door looking for the proof that you are driving that activity today. So please don't take anything that I'm about to say as taking the opportunity off that, because if you're not driving that, there will be no future. The risk, I think, for marketers today is that you only focus on that. And with the rise of full cycle marketing and automation and everything that offers, we have to keep remembering, though, the importance of brand that goes with it. And so for me, the foresight piece, to give you the Castrol example, you know, Castrol is a wonderful brand, 125-year-old brand, a rich history, had been used for generations in things like world land speed records, first flights, all sorts of things. We're really proud of the brand it is. But if you look kind of 30 years ahead, when the world transitions to electric vehicles or whatever the new forms of energy might be, lubricants as we know them today won't exist. Now, that's very difficult for me to talk to a customer through traditional customer research tools today, but I can logically look out 30, 40 years and recognise that I need to take the Castrol brand into new spaces for the future. Now, we will do that through lots of ways, like data centres is a new opportunity for us that the brand can naturally adjust to. But the point being that I can't make that transition today through some of those micro-targeting opportunities. I have to do that through brand-building activities that keep me relevant with the customers that I know will want to be in the Castrol brand in 10, 20 years, and how I keep the brand known, top of mind, mental availability, and all those good things. And so it has to be an and conversation, and I think that's where marketers are struggling today. I'm going to take on all of that hyper-targeted activity today to drive the sales. And again, if you don't do that, kind of go home. But you've got to do the brand stuff too to keep your brand relevant for the decades and generations to come. And, you know, that's where we're really kind of trying to say, how do we keep a brand that is 125 years old relevant for the next 125 years? And that's a challenge.
If we're thinking about diversification beyond just the customer, obviously we can talk about business models and so on, and perhaps in just a minute. But Edwin, let me come to you on this, because you know, often we think about, okay, well, let's simplify this for ourselves. Am I going to market a branded house, or am I going to go down the house of brands model? You know, L'Oreal, it's the biggest beauty brand in the world, but it's also managing 37 brands all at once. Now, how can you manage that level of diversity and show up to the tensions that must sit across the business models that those brands deliver? I mean, I know your CEO was at CES this year, showcasing new ways to play into the market, which I think was quite a departure for L'Oreal. So talk to us a little bit about how you show up successfully to 37 different brands every day.
Yes, no, I think it's a very good question, Maeve. And I don't think it's a white or black answer. I think it's more a spectrum of how you really position your mindset. So are you really talking about a corporate and just from the brand perspective, or are you really living a consumer-centric mindset and connecting that stream of the funnel with the other one? And I think the key for me is what you just referred to as tension. It's a little bit frustrating for me as an insights professional that I hear many times people referring to insights but stating facts. So like, you know, the insight we have is the market is declining. The insight that we have is that consumers really like this color or this flavor. Those are not insights, because there is no attention. If there is no attention, there is no insight. And I think if we leverage on that fundament, we need to connect these two streams through the attention. So, for example, for us as a group, it's really important that people know that L'Oréal as a group manage all of these brands and that they belong to this purpose of creating the beauty that moves the world. However, for many consumers around the world, maybe L'Oréal Paris, which is a brand, is connected to the L'Oréal as a group. So many people around the world talk about the two things. And I think the most important in the end is to keep consistency with the group purpose. So each one of the brands in its own way will feel kind of connecting to the tensions that each consumer has in its own way, but always within the frame of the purpose of the group. So I think both things are important. For the group, it is important to position both the brand and the group, but for the consumer, maybe that differentiation is not that important and is not as important as to feel that the brand is really talking to their attention. So for me, that's why I say it's not a white and black, because I know this does not provide a very sharp answer to how to do it. But I will say, first, start by the foundational of really focusing on the tensions that you have, finding those true insights that you want to leverage. Second, connecting the group purpose with the purpose of each one of the brands you position and making sure there is consistency, because consumers are more and more scrutinizing that consistency in communication. And third, make sure that we speak from the corporate and the brand position, but really, really feeding on the other spectrum of the funnel, which is the consumer need and the consumer tension and the consumer values and the experience and the feelings and all of that.
Let's talk about tension a little bit more, because there are just so many places we could take that. Nicola, one of the things I know is difficult is figuring out how do you divide your attention and, frankly, your finite budget into so many different spaces. And I'm sure a lot of the audience is wondering how you show up to that. And, you know, we are, I guess, living in a world where there is ever increasing pressure on how much resource you've got, whether that's the energy available, the attention consumers have, the budget you've got, the state of the economy. How do you reconcile all of these competing goals?
Don't know, anybody got a magic answer? That's what that really is. Look, again, it's trying to find your way through a short and long-term journey. So in the short term, that is where I hold out great hopes for the likes of AI, automation, even the role that offshoring can play for marketing and looking at kind of lower cost locations for some of the activities in which we do things. Because I think if we can free up and make today's marketing as efficient and effective as possible, it frees up the space for the longer term challenges that you're alluding to. Because I go back again to, you know, we're business people, and if we don't drive the value today with customers, and as you said, Edwin, the reality is that consumers each day aren't really thinking about brands. They just want the products, the services delivered to them in a way that, in a great customer experience that makes them feel good or make their life easier, whatever it might be. So we've got to find a way of getting effective, and some of the trials coming through with AI, Gen AI, that show what you can do in today's space to get creative, to market quicker, to reach people more effectively. I think that offers up some really great hope to make that part of marketing really, really efficient for the future, and therefore create a little bit of space for that longer term brand building piece, which is still so important. Because to your point about branded house or house of brands, and exactly as Edwin said, in the end, that is a long-term vision of what you want your brand or your corporation to stand for. But you can be sure that if you don't find a way to recognize how all your activities today ladder up, then there will be no change in the brand perception for the long term. And therefore you question the long-term health of that brand. So it's really difficult, is finding a way to balance all those tensions, but you've got to get the short term right to unlock the long term. And that's why I'm really hopeful for some of the new technologies out there today and what they could unlock for us.
If I can just push you a little bit further on that. So one of the points of tension is, and it's interesting because you work in such different industries, beauty and energy, I mean, it's a world apart. And yet there's this tension between leaning more into premium customers and also convenient choices that are at the more budget end of the spectrum. And both of these spaces are very different, but also growing and managing that. And convenience in particular, for you, Nicola, we see it's interesting because, you know, obviously on the forecourt, you can deliver a lot of convenience, but actually the rise and rise of convenience first brands coming into the mobility space is just seems to be relentless. How can you compete with new entrants, new business models, new, fresher ideas for the future? How do you manage that?
Yeah, great question. And for me, it does come back again to being ruthlessly focused on who you are targeting and why your customers come to you. It's so easy to get sucked into the world of just being obsessed by what competitors are doing. It's not to say don't focus on competitors. You need to do that too. But, you know, the Bezos quote about if you focus on competition, you are going to be less innovative than if you focus on what your customers need. And in a world where there are so many new entrants, really being ruthless on who your customers are, why they come to you, and if you are delivering what they need is really important. So on our BP gas stations, we know that for many of our customers, the main reason they come to us is still for high quality fuels. You still have people that have cars they care about. They want to look after their engines. They want to keep them running as effectively as possible. And they are the people that are aware of the difference in the quality of gas or petrol. And so if we let that quality slip, that's where we worry, because that's when we see our customers moving to maybe the convenience first entrance. But if we stay loyal to who our customers are and deliver what they need, then when they're with us, we can uptrade them to the convenience offers of the future. And we can then, you know, they will then buy the cup of coffee from us or the Marks and Spencer's Percy Pigs while you're on the site or whatever it is that might be at your local gas station. Now, of course, you have to look at what competitors are doing. And what we find some of these new entrants really leading on is the cutting edge digital technologies, because they tend to be digital first brands. But that's good, too, because it pushes us to stay ahead and competitive in that space. So you have to watch what your competitors are doing, mate. But you've equally got to be ruthless on who you are targeting and not get swayed into others. So I will regularly get the question from many people of, yeah, well, what about those people going to a supermarket? And it's very tempting to say, let's cut prices and then we'll bring those people in. But of course, if you cut prices, you're playing a different game. And if that's all you're going to be focused on, those customers tend to be people that will be more promiscuous and will just go somewhere else when somebody else lowers their prices. And these are the basics of marketing, right? And in a world which is so complex, again, we're thinking about all these new technologies and new opportunities, I find it really helps to go back to some of the basic principles of the four Ps, kind of who are you targeting, why, and really ruthlessly focus on that before worrying about anything else.
So we were talking right at the start about the role of the CMO and just how obviously challenging that is. And I'm sure many of you have seen a lot of the commentary. It's going to be a theme at Cannes this year. I would happily recommend you all read the article from Mark Ritson on this, simply because it's witty. He used the phrase horseshittery, I think, in the middle of it. So it's well worth a read. It's entertaining, if nothing else. But, you know, this idea of, you know, CMOs are all going to get fired. There were lots of American brands in particular who lost their CMOs this year and then 5 minutes later hired them all back again, of which McDonald's was one. And what I thought was really interesting about the McDonald's story, so Morgan Flatley earlier this year, not only did he not already certainly have enough to do this time, but he also took on new business models as part of what his day job is. So to the question, Edwin, you know, do you find that as part and parcel of the conversation that you're having to challenge the top table with regularly now? What's the next new business model that you guys at L'Oréal are having to think about and conquer?
Absolutely, absolutely. So you probably were familiar with the CES presentation earlier this year, where our CEO, Nicola Hieronimos, talked about our intention to be a beauty tech powerhouse. So L'Oréal as a group is really embarking on a technological and science-based journey towards the future. So really evolving in how our brands engage with consumers. You have seen probably examples of Maybelline with a partnership with Microsoft and Modiface, creating like the virtual looks for teams. Because now the reality is virtual I mean, remote work is part of our daily life after COVID. You probably have seen the HAPTA model that was created to basically provide women with disabilities or limitations in movement to be able to apply makeup. Because we, as I mentioned, as a group, we say we create the beauty that moves the world. And when it comes to the consumer products division, we democratize the best of beauty. So following this this line of thinking, my belief is the business needs to adapt to the emerging trends. And actually, one of the things that brought me to L'Oréal, I mean, one thinking that I was reading a lot when I was invited to join the group, because I have been in the group for less than 2 years, was an idea of the second CEO of the group many years ago. His name was François Dalle, and he said, we need to saisir ce qui commence, which is kind of seize what begins, really be able to seize what's beginning and do it at least between six to 18 months before it happens and it becomes mainstream. And I think that's kind of our obsession as a group, like really trying to be able to seize what is just beginning and adopting it really early. So now we are talking a lot about AI. What we did as a group was integrate AI in the development of the products, integrate, I mean, we have petabytes of information worldwide about skin diseases, skin conditions, hair care conditions. So we created a set of applications. You have heard, I mean, Nicola also mentioned in January this year, which was, by the way, the first time a beauty company was the keynote speaker in a technology global event. So it kind of connect with this shift of how we can rethink the business model, how we can reinvent and reframe the way we connect to consumers. And in that sense, I think Beauty Genius, for example, is L'Oréal Paris Beauty Genius, is an app that helps you do yourself your skin diagnostic and kind of recommend the products that you need to use based on your own style. So today, and your own needs and your own desires. So I think the use of technology, the desire to become a beauty tech powerhouse is a reflection of this change that we need to really drive to continue to be able to create the beauty that moves the world.
And of course, the use of apps and the route to market that gives you through first party data, which is, of course, not the world that you would have operated in before, is interesting. Nicola, I know we've talked about diversification of data and some of the experiments that you guys are leaning into with that and AI and so on. Would you expand on that topic that Edwin has raised?
Yeah. So data diversification is huge. Right, so I have two responsibilities, a look after the BP brand and look after the Castrol brand. And the Castrol brand is much more a brand that you will find in either a workshop or on the shelf in a Halfords or a Walmart or something like that. Whereas BP, obviously, gas station, we have lots and lots of loyalty data. And what's interesting is when you start to share the learnings across the brands on the power of that. Because if you look to the future, we want to have the view of kind of one single customer identifier. And we'd love to be able to recognize that a customer who's buying petrol from our gas station is also buying a lubricants product. But guess what? The kind of systems of the past don't allow us to do that, right? They're built on different platforms. The data is held in different places. The two don't connect. But that's where some of these opportunities for the future start to come in and where you can create these platforms. I don't have a L'Oréal equivalent at the moment, Edwin, but maybe for the future, where if you start playing into people's lifestyles and bringing them together, then you open up new business models, right? So a platform, maybe, we were talking about one in India where you can help people manage their entirety of their mobility needs, like you book their service for their car, as well as buy their product, as well as be reminded when they need to go and get a repair done or whatever that might be. And so the power of the kind of platforms that you're talking about, Edwin, is I think offers all sorts of opportunities. And again, the magic of getting into first party data across all of those products opens up all sorts of new business models for the future. And ultimately, it's so important, Maeve, because I go back again to, I need my brand Castrol to be as relevant in the next 125 years as it was in the past. And the reality is that means doing things differently. And so how you create the space to be able to have those future conversations as well as building on today is the challenge. And it goes back to those huge opportunities for marketers today to find a path through that and to open up diversification for what might come next.
So let me just issue a reminder that you're all being very shy on Slido, I have to say, today. We've got about 5 minutes left, so do get the questions in. Otherwise, I'm just going to keep on running here. One thing that you talked about, Edwin, a little bit earlier is, you know, the emerging trends and seizing them sufficiently early on. What's a signal that you wish you'd seen sooner?
Wow, that's a very good question, Maeve.
Yes.
I will refer to my former job experience to answer that. So I was working for the Electrolux group when COVID came. I think that's a signal I will have like to see before. It's what I call nature dynamics. Because I think COVID was a viral thing, but I believe now we are seeing global warming, you know, we're seeing floods in many countries around the world. You have seen the news of Dubai, you know, in the south of Brazil, there are, I think, more than 350 cities underwater today because of these things. And I think the power of nature is a signal I would have liked to have been able to see before it happened when it comes to COVID. Because what happened back then was, you know, people realized suddenly that they were living with appliances. And you could say, well, but we all know. But the relationship you have with your appliances dramatically shifted after COVID. You know, there was a guy in a research that we did in Germany, by the way, who said, you know, I hate my fridge. I was like, why? Because it's too noisy. I cannot work from home because it's really noisy. So I moved it to the bathroom. And I think that expresses a little bit how that that signal was manifested in the way you relate, or we all relate to appliances. Many people started redesigning their kitchens based on this. And then we were sold out. So the demand was there. Many people around the world wanted to buy more appliances, but we were not ready to respond to that supply. And because there were many other factors, you know, like the microchips shortage because of the international sea traffic and so forth. But that's definitely a signal I would have liked to see before, way before it happened.
Nicola, do you have one that you would pick?
It makes me think of COVID as well, of what we learned during COVID. And it speaks to your question of the kind of pro and con of ruthless customer centricity. So, you know, Castrol is known as a brand in the B2B area where we personalized a lot of products, right? If a B2B customer wanted a specific product, we could deliver it. We have amazing technologists that can do that. You know, if we needed a bespoke product for a space need or a truck need, we'd do that. And so we kind of develop personalized products for lots of people. COVID hits, and then we realize the downside of that. Right, because suddenly we needed products all over the world in different forms, and suddenly ingredients were limited and supply chains were disrupted. And suddenly you realize that we've gone so far down the customization route without the systems and the structure and the data in place to manage it, that we were really hit during COVID with the ability then to supply those products. And then it goes full circle to say, you know, did you take customer centricity too far? And how do you now meet all the personalization needs when maybe our competitors were actually, who had a simpler portfolio than us, were actually then able to deliver products that we couldn't deliver? And so it's really forced a kind of reassessment of, look, how far down that line do you go and how do you manage it? And perhaps more importantly, how do you put the systems, the processes, the technology in place to really be able to manage that kind of customer centricity to be prepared for the future and manage the fragmentation that goes with it? So, you know, loads of learnings in that, but I think you take COVID as an example of how we've all started to learn.
Well, we're suddenly, with 1 minute to go, getting lots of brilliant questions. let's go to this one. What is the role of an agency ecosystem for you as a CMO? Or what kind of partners would you both like to have with you on this journey towards the future? Perhaps both of you could speak to that quickly.
Yeah. Shall I have a go? Look, I summarise the challenges that I'm facing marketing in three ways at the moment. One, look, we live in a world where our cost bases don't allow us to spend what we used to spend on marketing, right? So how do you bring costs down? We live in a world where things are changing so fast that capabilities need to change so fast, right? You need people to upskill on a huge level very, very quickly. and you need a tech stack in place today, right? I look after a brand that stretches across 160 countries across the world. I have all sorts of tech stack solutions, as you can imagine, and none of them linking up really. And so suddenly, to make the most of AI automation, all those good things, I need a common approach to those kind of things very, very fast. And the simple answer to that is I need an agency support that is going to help me through that. How do I do all of that? And how do I work with you on it? Because I can't actually do it all in-house, even if I wanted to. So I've got to do it cheaper. I've got to do it faster. I've got to do it with a tech stack that works. I've got to find my way through the complexity. And how do you do that together? That's my simple summary.
Fantastic. And I know we're out of time, but Edmund, please, who are your vital partners in your day job?
Yeah, so I will build on this. I will just add that agencies are, of course, really important. And for me, the most important factor is that they bring a point of view. Mm-hmm. What I always ask is, what's your point of view? Because that's going to give me the contribution that you can have on the table. Then in the company, basically finance is really, really a key and a strategic partner, because we need to size things together, and it answers as well the question on the ROI. So it's about sizing. You know, it's not about just the stating, but being able to really seize and size. You know, you identify early and then you are able to bring a size to that opportunity. The transformation department is a key partner in action as well for Insights, because he's kind of she's one of my best friends in the company. And then we drive the transformation together. Of course, CDMO, so digital and marketing officers, the brand presidents. I will say, if I need to summarize, because I basically love working with all of my colleagues in the management committee, but I will say from an Insights perspective, finance, marketing, transformation, and commercial are kind of the key partners to drive action.
Brilliant. Well, on money and opinion and partnership matters, we will leave you there. Thank you all so much for joining us this afternoon. It's been great.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Advertising Week Europe 2024 in audio. Stay connected with us on social media using the handle @AdvertisingWeek, and visit our website europe.advertisingweek.com for more exclusive content. This podcast was produced by Podcanda, the audio conference solution.